Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the painful, confusing, debilitating world of autoimmune diseases and what we're learning about how these diseases came to be. When the immune system attacks healthy cells, it can cause a baffling array of symptoms. They present differently patient to patient. Doctors have a hard time diagnosing them. And even when the disease is pinned down, treating it can be exceedingly difficult. We'll talk to a senior editor at Scientific American about what researchers are learning about the origins of these illnesses and if there are better treatment options ahead. We'll also discuss why women are so disproportionately afflicted by autoimmune disorders. Our conversation starts after a short break. Us think of the immune system as that mysterious protector inside our bodies. We try to build it up by getting 8 hours of sleep, drinking green tea, eating kale, taking walks in the sunshine. Smoothie shops and vitamin manufacturers draw us in with promises of extra immune support, and why not take them up on it? The immune system is supposed to be our best defense. But what happens when the immune system turns on the very body it's supposed to safeguard? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. There are nearly 80 autoimmune disorders that cause a variety of debilitating symptoms for 50 million people in just the United States. And while historically these diseases have been very difficult to both diagnose and treat, researchers are learning more about the root causes of autoimmune disorders every day. John Fishman is a senior editor at Scientific American. He joins us now to talk about this issue's special report on autoimmunity. It's called The Body Against Itself. Josh, welcome to Think.
Hey, Courtney. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, let's sketch out kind of how autoimmune diseases work for people who aren't familiar with them, who don't suffer from one or have a loved one or friend who does. The basic idea is just kind of what the title of the report says, right? The body turns on itself.
That is the basic idea. You're right. And I like what you said at the opening about how this immune system is supposed to be our best friend. Autoimmune diseases happen when your best friend starts hating you. And it's a system, it's incredibly complicated. It's a network of cells and proteins that have evolved over billions of years to defend us against viruses like the one that causes COVID when it enters our body, or bacterial infections like tuberculosis. And what they're supposed to do, what the immune system is supposed to do, is supposed to mark these things as foreign, weird, not part of us, and mark them for destruction by cells called killer T cells. And that normally happens, except for roughly 180 million people in the world, it goes wrong. And they get marked, their own tissues get marked. Their pancreas, their hearts, their brains, their nerves get marked by the immune system for destruction. And that's why these things are called autoimmune diseases.
So as I mentioned when we first started the show, there are about 80 of these diseases, and they present really differently, kind of not just disease to disease, but also patient to patient, right?
Right. It's a area that is mysterious to medicine, even though medicine has made a lot of progress in understanding it over the last 50 years. But yeah, there are 80 diseases, and that ranges from things that you've probably heard of, like type 1 diabetes and multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, to things with names that you haven't really run across, like Hashimoto's disease or Graves' disease, or certain kinds of alopecia, where all the hair follicles in your body are attacked by the immune system and fall out.
And you mentioned alopecia, so I'm just going to kind of jump off of that point, because something that was interesting to me when I was reading through the articles that were part of the special report is that, you know, you'd think of alopecia, it had kind of been lumped in with maybe some skin disorders like psoriasis in the past, but it actually has more in common with MS than it does that, right?
Right. It's got some genes that are the same genes that appear to be activated in MS. And that's something that's only been discovered in the past, 4 to 5 years. And Courtney, what's really interesting about autoimmune diseases right now is that scientists are going through this big sea change in how they think about them, and how they think about alopecia and how they think about MS, because they used to think that these diseases were, that the immune system was the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just as you and I were talking about, it's the immune system going wrong. And it turns out that that might not be the entire story, that it may be the target tissues, the pancreas, say, in the case of type 1 diabetes, that's actually drawing the attention and the ire of this immune system by producing abnormal proteins, kind of sending up flares. And those flares attract things, part of the immune system called autoantibodies. Mm-hmm. And the autoantibodies act as homing beacons for these killer T cells. And the killer T cells are the things that zoom into the pancreas and do the damage by gobbling up and nibbling away at the insulin producing cells that are the things that you need to avoid diabetes. And when enough of them are damaged, you get type 1 diabetes. So that's a real difference. And, you know, in understanding how these diseases occur, it's not just the immune system behaving badly, it's parts of your body that may be luring it in.
So what does that kind of a discovery mean? If it's not just a haywire immune system, if it's maybe the target tissues themselves, is that encouraging news, or is that further complicate this already, you know, probably overwhelming field of medicine?
Well, if you ask me, it complicates things, and it's good news.
So both.
I wish that there was a one or the other answer. But, you know, the immune system is like this to me. It's just this crazy circuit with loops upon loops of feedback. And so, you know, this is just another extra loop which complicates things. But the good news about it is that it provides doctors and drug developers with another spot to try and intervene to stop this attack. That instead of trying to rein in a immune system gone rogue, they can look at the pancreas or the nerves and ask, well, what's attracting this immune system to these spots? And maybe we can put a shield there. And they've actually done that in a couple of cases.
And I definitely want to talk more later on about some of these advances, because, you know, it could really change the whole approach to treating autoimmune diseases. But I also want to spend a moment on the idea of why diagnosing these is such a long road for so many people. In this special report, there are many, many anecdotes about patients' experiences with getting diagnosed. I've read many others. Why is it so difficult for folks that end up eventually with an autoimmune disease diagnosis to get there?
Because it's not the first thing anybody thinks of. And I think that's because of what you said at the outset. It's the immune system. It's supposed to protect us. Who would go ahead and think that it's actually attacking us? And so what doctors look for is an outside force, you know, not your immune system. And the autoimmune diseases are always kind of the second or third or fifth thing that they're looking at. And the signatures of these diseases are not easy to find. They're proteins called autoantibodies. And we used to think that the autoantibody was the only signature that you could look for. But it actually turns out, just to make things confusing and difficult, that we all have autoantibodies. So just simply doing a diagnostic test for autoantibodies doesn't automatically say that you have an autoimmune disease. The autoantibodies have to be doing something pathological. They actually have to be drawing in these killer T cells and damaging tissue. And in some cases, they're not. Doctors don't really understand why they do in some cases and why they don't in other cases. So I think that's part of the answer to your question, that it's medically hard to come up with a foolproof test for these things. And I think that, frankly, the other issue is that a lot of the patients with autoimmune disease, a huge number of the patients, are women. And I think that when women have come in with symptoms saying, I'm tired, I've got a headache, and there's no, you know, there's no easy test that says, oh, okay, you've got, you know, cancer or you've got heart disease, that doctors have pawned this off and just said, it's all in your head. And I think that it's sexism, and I think that it happens to women more than guys.
I want to play a clip now of tennis star Venus Williams talking with CBS This Morning back in 2016 about her autoimmune disease.
For many, many years, I always felt like no matter how much I trained, I never had stamina. And so I would go to the doctor and say, I don't feel like I can get in shape. And so when you only have that symptom, you know, it's tough to find something. And then about 4 years ago, I felt like I wasn't getting enough air. And so I got diagnosed with exercise-induced asthma, but my medicines never worked. So for years and years and years, you know, I, you know, had trouble with stamina and continuing and just on and on and on, and until this summer when I started to have more definite symptoms outside of that.
That was Venus Williams. She has Sjogren's syndrome, which, according to this extremely cool table in the Scientific American piece, affects 1 in 10,000 people. So I'm assuming that's part of why physicians don't jump to that as a diagnosis. They don't see it all the time. But part of it is also something that you mentioned, that it's hard to pin down with symptoms like she described, and people either pawn it off as something that is in his or her head, or perhaps is something, you know, related to stress or fatigue.
Right. And, you know, that's a great story. That's Venus Williams. She's famous. She's got a lot of resources, and she couldn't even get the help that she needed. We tell the story in our special report of another woman, a medical doctor up at Harvard, who went through the same process of hopping from physician to physician because she had these tingly sensations in her fingers, and that she couldn't, you know, and weakness. And they kept telling her, it was all in your head. Well, it turned out not to be all in her head. It turned out to be her immune system attacking the outside lining of her nerves. And it took years for her to do that, and repeatedly asking for specialized tests. And, you know, and this is a physician, you know, this is, and it also happens to be a particularly strong-minded person. You know, so if she's got this problem and Venus Williams has this problem, just imagine how hard it is for people who are not as familiar with medicine, who don't have as many doctors on their side, who don't know the names for these symptoms. You know, it's just tough.
So Josh, just before we went to break, we kind of introduced this idea about women being dismissed by their providers if they have vague symptoms that may turn out to be autoimmune disorders. I was kind of blown away by the overrepresentation of women as far as autoimmune patients go. I bombarded my colleagues with this stat for days now because I was very surprised by it. Can you tell us the reality? How many more women are afflicted than men?
4 out of every 5 autoimmune patients is a woman. That's it. Plain and simple. 80%. That's actually 79 point something, but let's round up.
And that is like pretty staggering. Is that common knowledge across like even the medical field? Does everyone know this? Or is this like a secret that just isn't really talked about? I was just blown away. And I do a lot of reading for work, and I just had never heard anything like that before.
Well, I think people, doctors who treat arthritis and MS probably know about this, but I don't think that the rest of the world really knows that this is a women's club.
So I know there are a lot of potential reasons why it is that women are so overrepresented among this patient population. So can you start by talking a little bit about hormones and why they might be at the center of some of this?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So when you look at when these symptoms start, the symptoms of autoimmune diseases like MS or lupus, they are often picked up right around important life transitions, such as puberty or pregnancy and menopause. And what do these things have in common? Hormones. Particularly hormones like estrogen and progesterone. And those hormones are fluctuating. They tend to go up, and at puberty, they tend to change during pregnancy, and they change again during menopause. And so does the level of testosterone, which women produce as well. So there's something going on that's a connection to hormone levels. And it's probably that these hormones play a role in regulating immune system activity. They can suppress it or they can exacerbate it. And so this whole question of autoimmunity, to my mind, is a question of balance. You want your immune system to be active because you want it to keep out viruses, but you don't want it to be overactive because when it's overactive, it's going to start nibbling away at your own body. And these hormones, when they start changing levels, they can send the immune system out of whack.
And testosterone appears to be a bit of a warder offer when it comes to autoimmune disorders, right? Because even men with low levels of testosterone, they're more likely to have an autoimmune disorder.
Yeah, that's right. Testosterone is a immunosuppressive hormone. So if you've got a lot of it, it will stop immune system activity. If you've got a little of it, it's going to allow more immune system activity to basically break through.
Let's talk a little bit about genetics, the X chromosome. I'm not going to try to summarize this point because I feel like I will do a pretty inelegant job of it, but the X chromosome could hold some really interesting information about autoimmune diseases as well.
Right. And this is very much tied into that statistic of 4 out of 5 people with autoimmune diseases are women. One thing that women have that men don't are 2 copies of the X chromosome. Men have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. And traditionally medicine and science have thought that women have two copies of this chromosome, but the extra genes on the extra copy are turned off to prevent people from getting what's called a double dose. Mm-hmm. But recently, doctors have learned that these extra genes are often not silenced. And again, this is a kind of perturbation where you're getting an extra amount of a molecule in the body, and that could be sending a signal, one of these flares that we talked about mm-hmm. early on. You know, it could be sending a signal to genes that activate the immune system and revving it into high gear when it shouldn't be revved into high gear. Or it could be producing markers on cells, your own cells, that mark them as something the immune system should be worried about, and the immune system could swoop in and attack them.
Basically, they're being flagged as a problem.
Yes, exactly.
Walk me through this fascinating pregnancy compensation hypothesis, where the actual way that women's bodies must accommodate pregnancy could also be partially an explanation for why women are so likely to get an autoimmune disorder.
Sure. It's another one of these immune system conundrums and complexities. So forgive me if I kind of get lost in the weeds here.
I'll try to keep you on the path.
Because it's easy to do. So pregnancy is a kind of it's a crucial part of our life experiences, but it's also an unusual part of our life experience in that we have these bodies when we're born that are all us, right? You know, like every part of it is genetically the same. And then if you're a woman, you get pregnant, and you have got this fetus growing inside you that has half of its genetic material from another person, right? With me so far?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
there's definitely some foreign body action going on. If you think about the fetus,
right,
is not all you.
Yeah, exactly. It's not all you. And that presents your body with a problem, because if the immune system does what the immune system did when you were a little kid and swoops in and destroys anything that's non-you, then it's going to swoop in and target the growing fetus. You don't want that to happen. That's no way for the survival of the species, right? Mm-hmm. So women's bodies have evolved a complex series of mechanisms for suppressing the immune response during pregnancy. And so the immune system allows this foreign body, or this half foreign body, to keep growing. But the tolerance and the suppression is another weird thing that the immune system has to incorporate into itself. And one of the interesting things is that with a lot of immune diseases, the symptoms get tamped down during pregnancy, which is an indication that your body is telling the immune system, okay, even though there's this unusual creature inside, we're going to let it be. Slow down. Don't go after it. But the immune system, in the meantime, is kind of storing up a lot of energy. And then after birth, that programming, that energy is still there. And the symptoms flare up as all of these molecules in the immune system go, all right, let's see what's around here. Let's go after it. And so, you know, pregnancy and the pregnancy compensation hypothesis says that this deal that we strike with the immune system is something that is kind of a Goldilocks effect. You know, a little, you know, too little is too bad. Too much is also bad. Let's hit the just right during pregnancy. But then you remove the pregnancy and you've still got the immune system running full tilt and it's got new targets.
And interestingly enough, not to make a generalization about like the olden days, but women live longer now, maybe having fewer children in general. And that means they spend less of their lives pregnant, right? So not as much time to be pregnancy immune suppressed as there was, you know, maybe 40 years ago.
Yeah, that's a good point, Courtney. So, you know, again, that's kind of more time for autoantibodies and killer T cells to wander around your body looking for trouble.
You're listening to Think. Let's go to Chill in Austin. Chill, what's your question?
Hey, good day. I just want you to know I have MS. I didn't know I had it for a long time, supposedly, because I was definitely physically active. I guess the symptoms hadn't caught up to me until about a couple of years ago. I was told that I had dementia. I had all these other stuff until they nailed down finally that I had MS. And even that was hard for them. My question is this, after doing some research, how is, and since I'm male, it's also interesting, how is autoimmune disorders linked to food? The whole leaky gut and having the brain, having the quote-unquote brain in your gut, how does that affect the autoimmune response or what it can and can't do? And what is the suggested diet for that? I was told many times that the Mediterranean diet was healthy. Do we go on autoimmune protocol, you know, that limits a lot of stuff? What are the solutions that you see from that state? And I'll take my call offline.
Thanks for the call. So what do you think? How does gut health tie in to autoimmune disorders?
It's a really good question, and it's something that scientists are getting more and more interested in. And it seems that the diversity of friendly bacteria in your gut, it's called your gut microbiome, that might have something to do with it. Those bacteria that are in your intestines, they send signals to your brain sends signals to them. More diversity is better. And are you familiar with something called the hygiene hypothesis? Courtney?
I'm not.
Okay. It's this interesting idea that surfaced about 25 years ago when researchers started noticing that people who grew up in cities, when compared to people who grew up in rural areas like farms, had more diseases. And the hygiene hypothesis holds that it's a good idea to be exposed to some germs early on in your life because it educates your immune system, kind of trains it. And in cities where we've got all of this sanitation and you're not running around outside quite so much, you're not as exposed to as many different kinds of bacteria. So when your body runs into that bacteria, the immune system doesn't sound an alarm and it lets that bacteria get a hold and grow into a big infection and you get sicker. So that's the hygiene hypothesis. Something very similar to that has turned up in autoimmune disease research in this interesting study that was done in Finland and Russia. So after World War II, there was a part of Finland and Russia that kind of got an artificial border drawn across it. It's called Karelia. And so it became Finnish Karelia on the western side and Russian Karelia on the eastern side. And Finnish Karelia developed a lot faster. It got richer. There were more jobs. It got more sanitation, more medicine, whereas the Russian side of the border didn't. And what happens when you look at the incidence of autoimmune disease is that you see a lot more autoimmune disease on the Finnish side, the part with the better jobs and the more money and the better sanitation and better medicines, and less of it on the Russian side. So it's kind of an echo of that hygiene hypothesis, saying that being exposed to germs early on has some benefits. And when the researchers looked at the microbiome in these people's guts, what they found was that there was a lot more diversity in the microbes on the Russian side than there was on the Finnish side, which indicates that there was more exposure to a bunch of different germs on the Russian side.
So Josh, right before we went to break, you were talking about kind of the connection between gut health and that microbiome inside your gut and autoimmune disorders. So I want to let you finish your point about how the two kind of connect to each other.
Right. Thanks, Courtney. It really seems like diversity in your gut microbiome, the bacteria that live there, is a helpful thing. And that when it becomes monoculture, when it becomes all the same kind of bacteria, you get a lot more autoimmune diseases. And so, you know, that's something that scientists have been exploring. They've also been looking at it particularly with ulcerative colitis, which is a subtype of irritable bowel syndrome, and it's an autoimmune disease. And researchers have been experimenting with fecal transplants, which is an experimental technique where you wipe out all the gut microbes that are there and you transplant in some gut microbes from somebody else. And it seems in a couple of clinical trials that when you try this in ulcerative colitis, a third of the patients went into remission. And that's as good as what you get when you put these type of patients on steroids, which is the go-to standard big hammer drug used for a lot of autoimmune diseases. So that indicates that there is something going on with your gut microbiome that goes wrong, and that's connected to autoimmune diseases.
I want to talk a little bit about lupus, which is one of those autoimmune diseases that I think people hear a lot about. And one of the reasons is several celebrities have shared about their own experiences with the disease. So we're going to hear from one of them now.
I guess I got to the point where it was really kind of life or death. It's really hard to think about or even to swallow, especially now that as soon as I got the kidney transplant, my arthritis went away. My lupus, there's about a 3-5% chance it'll ever come back. My blood pressure is better. My energy, my life has been better.
So that was actress and singer Selena Gomez talking on the Today Show back in 2017 about her kidney transplant that was necessary due to lupus. How common is it to get a transplanted kidney? Lupus attacks a lot of different kind of tissues and organ systems, right? Is a kidney transplant status quo?
No. I think that a kidney transplant, I don't have numbers on it, but I think that a kidney transplant isn't kind of, it's not a treatment that you would get. It's not a situation where a doctor would say, oh, you have lupus, let's treat it by transplanting a kidney. But one of the horrible and nasty things that lupus does is it attacks many body organs, and the kidney is a prime target. So the kidney can be damaged, and damaged so severely that your only option for survival is a kidney transplant.
Why is lupus called the great imitator?
Well, it is a disease that mimics a lot of other diseases, because maybe it's a kidney disease, as we just heard. It attacks the kidneys. Maybe it's arthritis, because it attacks your joints. Maybe it's a lung disease, because you have trouble breathing, because autoantibodies and T cells start infiltrating your lungs. So it is a disease with many, many faces, and none of them are nice.
You share at the beginning of this series about one of your friends' younger sisters and her battle with lupus.
Yeah, my old friend John and his kid sister Annie. Annie was diagnosed right around, I think, age 11 with lupus. And she was a great singer. She loved musical theater. She struggled with this disease for 40 years. And she had a successful career, and she worked in politics. She worked in children's television, and all that time she would have bouts of great pain. And eventually she died at age 49.
One thing I kept thinking about as I read through this special report was, when you have a disease that you have a really clear test for, any number of things, like you were saying, cancer or heart disease, where they can kind of look at the markers of your symptoms, test for it, and give you a diagnosis, and there's kind of a traditional treatment plan, it can be incredibly disruptive. It can be really painful. You can be very sick. It feels so much more linear to me, though, when I read about autoimmunity, because, like you said, half the time you don't know what you're dealing with. And even when you do, you're not really sure what it's going to look like today, or if it's going to go completely away for a year, if it's going to come back and look opposite the next time you have a flare. What does that do to the patient's mental health, not knowing what they're dealing with, and then even when they do, having no clue how it's going to kind of unfold?
Drives you nuts. It can make you really depressed. Maria Konnikova, one of our writers, has struggled with an autoimmune related disease herself. And it was her sister, the Harvard doctor that I was talking about earlier, who was consistently misdiagnosed. And Maria was running from doctor to doctor, and this disease manifested itself as a skin condition. You know, it was horrible, itchy hives all over her body. She could barely wear clothes. And she's a highly successful writer and now poker player. And she basically didn't know what to do. She was housebound for a year. She was depressed. She was frustrated. She was angry. It does take a toll on your mental health. As you know, if you've ever been sick with a long-term illness, you want to know that there's a light, somewhere at the end of the tunnel, that even if the treatment is not working now, that it's going to take some time and it's going to work. And with autoimmune diseases, it's tougher. You don't know. There are people, because our genetics are all different, for whom a treatment for psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis will work great and their autoimmune problem will go away. And for other people with psoriasis or rheumatoid arthritis, that same treatment will not work. And, you know, just imagine how frustrating it is.
So is the traditional approach when it comes to autoimmune diseases been hammer it with steroids? Is that kind of the course of treatment that most physicians have followed so far?
Yes, that's been the traditional big stick, that you've got a problem with your immune system. It's running out of control. We have this one type of drug and it basically suppresses all immune system activity. So that's what we're going to use. And that's fine, except that by suppressing all of your immune system activity, it leaves you vulnerable to passing bacteria, viruses, and other kinds of infections that your immune system is supposed to ward off.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I was saying it may do great things for inflammation, I'm assuming, and that can give you a lot of relief as far as symptoms, but it leaves the side door open, and that could make for a really, I don't know, I'm trying to think of how you might feel if you were on serious steroids during cold and flu season or during COVID, for example.
You probably feel like you want to hide in your house. And steroids also have other side effects, you know, that they make your body swell up. They can make it really hard to sleep. You know, they're great drugs in the short term, but with autoimmune disease, which is often a multi-year battle, they can make your life really hard. So the push now is for more targeted therapies that aren't quite such a big and broad stick, but that simply interfere at the spot of damage. You know, find the molecule that's causing the psoriasis flare or the rheumatoid arthritis flare and interfere with that. And there's been some success with those drugs.
I want to go to one last call now from Mary in Austin. Mary, go ahead and ask your question.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was diagnosed or sort of semi-diagnosed when I was 23. I'm 61 now with chronic fatigue syndrome. But then again, they didn't know exactly what it was. And, you know, and most doctors said it was in my head. And I got tired of learning about it for so many years. I've really stopped researching about it. But anyway, my thought and question is, I got married and had three girls, and during the pregnancy, I've always said those were the best times I've ever felt, was during pregnancy. So I wanted to get your comment or thoughts on, and it could be chronic fatigue syndrome. My sister has lupus, the other one fibromyalgia, and I have chronic fatigue syndrome. So something's going on, we just don't know. But my thought was during the pregnancy, was I right in feeling that it was suppressed, that the symptoms were suppressed?
What do you think?
Well, Mary, from what I know and from what medical science knows, yeah, you're right, dead on, that it seems that during pregnancy, a lot of autoimmune symptoms are suppressed. And again, that seems to be that pregnancy compensation idea that the body is slowing down your immune system in order to allow the fetus a chance to grow.
So you talked a little bit about targeted therapies. One of the ones that was mentioned in this series of articles that was so interesting to me is it's not just drugs. They're doing some really fascinating things. You mentioned fecal transplants, but they're also stimulating certain nerves, like jolting the vagus nerve. How could that have anything to do with alleviating symptoms of an autoimmune disease?
I know it sounds pretty wacky, doesn't it? Except that it works. So there's a reputable scientist, a guy named Kevin Tracy, who has experimented with stimulating the vagus nerve, which is one of the major nerves in the body with branches that go all over the place. I'm just trying to remember what Tracy was looking at. Rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease. And he found that when the vagus nerve was stimulated with these little electrical pulses, that it reduced the symptoms of both of those diseases. And why does that work? The vagus nerve, well, I'll admit right away, I don't really know. And I don't think Kevin Tracy really knows, but the vagus nerve is one of the main nerves that connects the gut to the brain. And in a disease like Crohn's disease, which is a digestive problem, we know that those interactions and those signals are important. So it could be setting something right that has gotten slightly off kilter.
My guest this hour was Josh Fishman, senior editor with Scientific American. The special report in the September issue is called The Body Against Itself. Josh, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Courtney, it was lovely talking with you, and let's do it again.
Sounds good to me.